Always a pleasure to hear Dr. Crump speak. Our next speaker is Dr. Matt Chung. And Dr. Chung graduated from medical school in 1999 at the University of Toronto. He completed residency programs in internal medicine and hematology at University of Toronto. And then he completed a clinical and research fellowship in lymphoma and a Canadian Institute of Health Research postdoctoral research fellowship. In 2006, he obtained a master's degree in clinical epidemiology at Harvard School of Public Health. He joined the medical staff at Odette Cancer Center at Sunnybrook as a clinical investigator and clinical hematologist in 2007. And he's currently an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Toronto. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Matt Chung.
Okay, well, thanks so much for that kind introduction. It's really a pleasure to be able to participate in this panel today. So my talk today will be on understanding the indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I'd like to try and do this by illustrating the cancer journey for one of my patients with indolent lymphoma, and hopefully by doing so we can emphasize some of the questions that we should be asking our doctors, as well as highlight some of the treatment options or current standard options for indolent lymphoma, as well as looking towards the future options. And most importantly, I think we'll still have some time afterwards to participate in this panel discussion and answer your questions, which is really the goal of today. So as this audience really well knows, everyone's cancer journey is quite unique. So I want to bring up my patient's journey, not to explain what's typical about indolent lymphoma, but just to bring up some of the issues that that can come up for discussion. So I've known this individual, Mrs. Y, for about 5 years now since I've actually come on staff. In fact, she was actually one of my first patients at Sunnybrook Hospital. At the time, she was 50. She was married with two children, and she'd actually noticed even before I met her, a bump in her neck for a few years. She generally felt well and just wanted to ignore it. And it wasn't until her husband just persistently bugged her to get it looked at by her family physician that she came to medical attention. So very similar story to what we've heard even in the video today, as well as what some of the other speakers have mentioned. Ultimately, she came to medical attention. She had a CT scan. It did show a further lymphadenopathy, and she pursued. This is a diagram of a needle biopsy as guided by the CT scan. And then under the microscope, we see this biopsy consistent with a diagnosis of indolent lymphoma, and specifically follicular lymphoma. So what are the indolent lymphomas, and how do they differ from the aggressive lymphomas that Mike has already been talking about? Again, these are the cancers of the immune system cells or lymphocytes, and these are all subtypes of non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. We tend to at least clinically separate the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas into whether they behave and grow aggressively versus whether they grow a little bit more slowly. So the aggressive lymphomas, as Mike has already gone over, are characterized by more rapid tumor growth. Patients often present with symptoms, and if left completely untreated, can actually be fatal over a relatively short period of time. In contrast, the indolent lymphomas are characterized by slower tumor growth. Like our patient, Mrs. Y, they can often be asymptomatic, and they're associated with a very long natural history, often measured in many, many years. One of the very important distinguishing features between these lymphomas is that the standard chemotherapy drugs that we use to treat these conditions, as Joan has mentioned, these are drugs that really attack rapidly dividing cells and so have the potential to cure the aggressive histology lymphomas, whereas for the indolent lymphomas, although they are very very useful and still are quite helpful in terms of controlling symptoms, we generally consider the indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphomas to be incurable with standard therapies. And just like Mike used diffuse large B-cell lymphoma to illustrate the aggressive lymphomas, I'll be mainly talking about follicular lymphomas, the prototypical indolent lymphoma. So this is similar to the slide that Peter already showed. And this is just to illustrate that the follicular lymphoma subtype is probably the most common indolent lymphoma, representing almost a quarter of all lymphomas in general. But there are some additional indolent lymphoma subtypes, including small lymphocytic lymphoma, marginal zone lymphoma, or MALT lymphoma, lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma, or hairy cell leukemia. And unfortunately, out of just the interest of time, we won't be able to talk about some of these specific subtypes. But a lot of the principles that guide our treatment of the follicular lymphomas, as well as a lot of the evidence behind treating some of the other lymphomas, really are extrapolated from follicular lymphoma. So we'll really focus put that for this talk. So delving down into a bit more detail, what is follicular lymphoma? So again, it's the most common indolent lymphoma. On biopsy appearance, we tend to see that these lymphoma cells cluster into these spherical groupings or clusters, and you can almost vaguely see that as a nodular pattern on this biopsy. So typically, these are what's described as follicles, hence the name of the actual diagnosis. Looking at it even more detail, you can actually see that these are small lymphoma cells that are derived from the B-cell origin. And I won't go into any more about the diagnosis since it's been covered by the previous talks. So who gets this diagnosis? It is slightly more common in women than in men. In terms of ethnicities, it's slightly less common in Asians and blacks compared to other ethnicities. It's really got a wide spectrum of presentations, but generally individuals who get follicular lymphoma are adults, with the average age being around 60. As mentioned already, the natural history can be very, very long, and many of these years can be spent completely well and asymptomatic. And because we don't have a cure with our standard therapies, often the goal of our care is to maximize an individual's quality of life. And the role of treatment really just comes in when we're looking at the presence of symptoms. What are the symptoms of lymphoma? I think Peter's covered this really nicely as well. But again, the majority, or about two-thirds of patients with indolent lymphoma, present really with just persistent and painless enlargement of their lymph nodes. We've already talked a little bit about some of the general B symptoms. And again, symptoms can arise related to a lower blood cell count. So if the red blood cell count is low, patients can have fatigue. Or if there are low white blood cell counts, we can have this propensity to frequent infections. With low platelet cells, we can be predisposed to bleeding or bruising. But again, remember that less than 20% of our patients actually have general symptoms at onset. Even those that have very characteristic symptoms and enlarged lymph nodes, we can't really make the diagnosis just presumptively. Again, it emphasizes the need to pursue an excellent excisional lymph node biopsy, ideally. And again, I won't go over the staging and diagnostic tests that Peter really went over. But I will just talk a bit about the importance of staging as it relates to the indolent lymphomas. So why do we stage the indolent lymphomas? Well, firstly, again, as Peter mentioned, it helps us determine the prognosis or likelihood of outcome. And this is information based on a fairly large study, international study of thousands of patients published a few years ago. And they found that there were some independent risk factors that could tell us a bit about how aggressive the patient's lymphoma biology was. And so we found that people who were a little bit older or who had higher stages of disease, people who had lower blood cell counts, more lymph node areas, or as Mike mentioned, a marker of tumor burden, the blood level of LDH being increased, those were independent factors that told us a little bit about the aggressiveness of the lymphoma. And although the Follicular Lymphoma International Prognostic Index, or FLIPI score, can tell us a bit about the outcome, it's certainly not a perfect test. There's actually already a sequel to it, the FLIPI-2. But it can be helpful in just informing our discussions about, you know, how likely we think treatment might be coming up in the next few years, how likely people might respond to the treatment once they have to start it, and even life planning or overall survival discussions. The other reason we stage, again, Peter has gone over this, but it can tell us the extent of lymphoma in the body. It can sometimes forewarn us of any organ injury that might arise from the lymphoma. It can actually tell us a bit about when and what treatment is needed. So I won't go over again, but we would consider stage 1 or stage 2 to be limited stage indolent lymphoma, where there's really localized involvement with lymph nodes, and advanced stage lymphoma to be lymph nodes above and below the diaphragm, or the potential that the lymph nodes is involving an area outside of the lymph node system. And this directly influences our discussions about treatment. So individuals with limited stage indolent lymphoma, or stage 1 or stage 2 indolent lymphoma, First of all, these are a little bit less common in terms of the presentation of indolent stage lymphoma. So ultimately, we would see people with advanced stage disease. But if it does occur in a limited stage, as John has mentioned, this is generally considered encompassable within a radiation field, then often these individuals actually respond very well to a field of radiation directly to the area where we see the lymph node involvement. And there are actually very good long-term studies, actually some of them from Princess Margaret Hospital, that show us that individuals with limited stage disease, whether it's because of the biology of their lymphoma, for some reason that it's showing up as limited stage disease, or maybe it's the effectiveness of the radiation itself, some of these individuals can actually do very, very well if you follow them out 10 plus years. Many of them even maintain that long-term remission from radiation alone. When we're dealing with advanced stage lymphoma, this is actually the more common presentation that we would see. Again, unfortunately, these diseases are incurable with our standard therapies. And so without a cure, and because often patients can be asymptomatic for long, long periods of time, our focus is on quality of life and symptom control. So if someone actually doesn't have any symptoms, we often feel comfortable taking an observation or, as Peter mentioned, a watch and wait approach. When symptoms do develop, our treatments are still really effective in hopefully getting people back to a period of being symptom-free. So the big question with this type of approach, though, is if there are no symptoms, whether really instituting early treatment right away would make any difference compared to a watch and wait approach in terms of survival. And at least from that question, it has been studied. So this is an example of one randomized trial from the British National Lymphoma Investigation Group, where they took about 300 patients with indolent lymphoma, and they randomly assigned them to either being followed, what they call the watch and wait approach, or to an early simple chemotherapy treatment, an oral drug called the chlorambucil. And what they found in terms of the most important outcomes for patients was that in terms of lymphoma-specific survival or overall survival, there was certainly no difference between whether patients started off just being observed or whether they started right away with chemotherapy. But the advantage of just being watched was that they were able to avoid some of the early side effects of treatment. If you look only at the patients who were followed in the watch and wait approach, on average, individuals did at some point need treatment because of symptoms, about 2.5 years from diagnosis. But if you continue to follow them for a longer length of time, in fact, about 1 in 5 of the study participants actually did not require any treatment, even following them 10 years out from the original time of the study. And if individuals were about 70 or older at the time of their diagnosis, 2 out of 5 of them actually did not require any treatment. Now, there is some current research looking at, again, the approach of watch and wait with with more novel treatments like rituximab that Mike has already talked about. And the advantage of using rituximab with it would be that you might be able to avoid the kind of classic side effects of chemotherapy drugs, although, as you might anticipate, it might be a more costly approach. And some of the early evidence from these studies have suggested that if you use early treatment with immunotherapy, compared to, again, the watch and wait approach, you certainly are able to delay the next line of treatment or the need to start your next line of treatment, and that would make sense. But in terms of the more important outcomes, I think, for patients, again, the lymphoma-related survival or the overall survival, I think we're going to have to wait a little bit longer for this research to mature before we see those results. So certainly, back to our individual, Mrs. Y, she did complete her staging investigations, and she was found to have bone marrow involvement as well as some additional areas of lymph node involvement, and so was considered stage 4 follicular lymphoma. We started on a watch-and-wait approach, and she initially described quite a bit of anxiety and distress related to being followed for her lymphoma. She actually called it a watch-and-worry approach. She would tell us that certainly around the time frame of her appointments, she would actually get very unwell, very tired, more irritable. She described butterflies in her stomach, nervous. And she always described this underlying fear of dying, abandoning her children, who were still actually quite young at that time. And ultimately, she did come to terms over time with being comfortable with the watch and wait approach. She accessed supports at our own hospital, patient and family support programs. She had a peer support from the Canadian Cancer Society, and she was really able to talk out her fears, be honest with herself, with that peer support, with that peer. And she also really took to educating herself about lymphoma, and I think all of those were quite helpful. The American Institute of Cancer Research talks about really some of these things, being gentle with yourself, being able to be honest and talking it out with loved ones, taking care of yourself, and this gets to healthy living, diet, exercise, really empowering yourself by learning more about your lymphoma. That's what everyone here is doing today, and asking for support. And in terms of what supports are available, really there are quite a lot. We're really lucky to be in, many of us at least, in Toronto and really everywhere in the province there are supports. So many of our hospitals have patient and family support programs that include psychology, psychiatry colleagues, social work, nutrition, and support for family and caregivers as well. Many centers have patient education centers where you can access excellent information about your lymphoma. And there are a network of community organizations that can be quite helpful as well. Wellspring has lymphoma support groups and connections for young people with cancer. They have excellent exercise programs. As we've learned already today, the Lymphoma Foundation of Canada has just a ton of education and support programs, and other programs as well are available from other organizations. Ultimately, for some people, the anxiety itself can make it difficult to follow the watch and wait approach. And so in some circumstances, we do have to actually start treatment for that indication alone. But there are other physical indications or reasons that we would start treatment. And some of those, again, include the symptoms that we've talked about earlier, the B symptoms, symptoms related to low blood counts, our concerns related to the threats of enlarging lymph nodes, compressing organs like the liver or the kidney, bulky disease or bulky organs like the spleen. And as Mike mentioned, there is that potential, although it's rare, that lymphomas like follicular lymphoma can actually transform or evolve or turn into a more aggressive lymphoma like diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. It's not common. It happens about 3% or so per year. But when it does happen, that represents a need to start pretty immediate therapy. In terms of what treatments we do offer, really the historical backbone over many decades has been combinations of chemotherapy drugs. One of the more common Canadian options would be the use of cyclophosphamide, vincristine, and prednisone, or CVP. Again, given every 3 weeks intravenously for a total of anywhere from 6 to 8 cycles of treatment, so it spans about 4.5 to 6 months of treatment. There have been studies really over the 80s and the 90s that have looked at increasing the dose intensity of combination chemotherapy, for instance, using the CHOP backbone. And although initially these would improve the response rates, it wasn't clear that this would actually change the overall survival of our patients with indolent lymphoma, and ultimately they were associated with more toxicity as well. So it led to kind of this exploration of whether we could specifically target lymphoma cells while leaving other tissues, healthy tissues alone. And that's how, you know, it came that CD20 was identified as potentially a good target, and why we developed, why smart people developed rituximab. So as Mike has already mentioned, an engineered antibody, it actually has a mouse component which recognizes the CD20 protein on the surface of B cells, and that it actually has a humanized portion which is able to recruit our own body's immune system to specifically home in and kill lymphoma cells. So this is why we term it a type of immunotherapy. It's actually recruiting our body's own immune system to attack or control our lymphoma. And now in multiple international studies, including Canadian studies, in multiple combinations with chemotherapy drugs like CVP or CHOP, and with fairly long-term follow-up, we've seen repeatedly now that when we add rituximab to chemotherapy compared to just chemotherapy by itself, that there's actually a survival benefit with the addition of rituximab, and not at the cost of really additional toxicity. So especially with that added benefit of, so at this point in time, we would consider the use of rituximab along with an induction combination of chemotherapy to be the kind of standard first-line treatment in follicular or other indolent lymphomas. And with that benefit of it not being too toxic, there was a lot of interest in seeing whether or not we could continue to use rituximab almost as a maintenance type of treatment. And so this was looked at more recently as a modality of treatment in the PRIMA study, another international study, and they asked individuals with symptomatic follicular lymphoma to first receive an induction treatment with rituximab and a choice of chemotherapy drugs. And if they responded to that, they were then again randomized or randomly assigned to treatment with either maintenance rituximab given every 2 months for a total of 2 years or simply observed. And what they found, again, this is another one of those Kaplan-Meier curves, or what we call survival curves, but this is looking at really the proportion of people on the y-axis that remain progression-free, plotted against an x-axis of time. And what you see is that if you received maintenance rituximab in the red line, you actually have a slower rate or an improved rate of progression compared to if you actually had just observation alone. And you can actually see at 2 years that a pretty impressive number, more than 80% of people remained free of any progression. And so we would assume at this point in time, or at least in Canada, that one of the standards is a combination of rituximab with chemotherapy. Again, mostly in Canada, we would use CBP. There is, or at least in the United States, I would say probably more commonly CHOP chemotherapy, although our feeling is that may be potentially a little bit more toxic. It hasn't as yet shown an overall survival benefit to warrant choosing it. And following a response to that, consideration of using maintenance rituximab for 2 years. So how can we further improve on this current standard? Well, in terms of the chemotherapy backbone, there's been a lot of interest in actually an older drug called bendamustine. Bendamustine has actually been developed, I think, over 30, 40 years ago in Germany, and it's actually considered what we call a bifunctional chemotherapy drug. So it actually has this component that looks a little bit like our cyclophosphamide class of drugs, the alkylator agents, and that it has this other class of drug appearance as well, a purine analog. So it's almost like you get two drugs in one. And there was a German study published recently that looked at a comparison of bendamustine with rituximab, seeing if it was at least equivalent or at least not inferior to the use of CHOP and rituximab. And what they found was that response rates were very high and essentially equivalent in both groups. If anything, there seemed to be a better disease control in terms of progression-free survival in individuals who got the bendamustine with rituximab, and a delay in the time before needing another treatment in individuals who got the bendamustine and rituximab. And it seemed to be even a bit better tolerated than CHOP, so individuals had less mouth sores, less infections, and didn't lose their hair, which patients tend to really appreciate. Overall survival was not different in between the two arms. So bendamustine in Canada has actually just this month received its Health Canada approval, and the provinces are actually now looking at the funding of it. So it might become a new treatment option available for us very soon. Are there additional ways we can improve? So looking at additional targeted therapies would be what we're really studying at this point in time. So we've already seen the first generation anti-CD20 antibodies with rituximab, and there are multiple second generation antibodies already fairly advanced into clinical trials. There's the ability of using the same anti-CD20 antibody but attaching a particle of radiation to it, what we call radioimmunoconjugates, and in that way targeting radiation specifically to the lymphoma cells, but again avoiding healthier tissue. And there are already a couple of compounds available commercially. There are other monoclonal antibody drugs being developed against, for instance, other B-cell antigens. And there is the ability to target the intracellular communication or cell signaling pathways that kind of govern why lymphoma cells develop and grow. And again, there are multiple inhibitors of these pathways in development and in clinical trials. And finally, there's been a little bit more interest just recently in targeting the cells, not the lymphoma cells themselves, but the cells that kind of nourish or surround or support the malignant potential for lymphoma to develop, what we call the microenvironment. And one of the drugs that is thought to have some effects on the microenvironment and potentially some effects as well in potentiating or increasing the ability of rituximab to kill indolent lymphoma is a drug called lenalidomide. So lenalidomide is not a classic chemotherapy drug. It's what's considered an immunomodulatory drug. So again, a drug that modifies our own immune system to directly control lymphoma. And there's just a small example of a study that was done in individuals with different types of indolent lymphoma, like follicular lymphoma, small lymphocytic lymphoma, and marginal zone lymphoma. But the bottom line was that response rates were actually quite high with the combination of lenalidomide and rituximab, especially in patients with follicular lymphoma. And I think because of this, the National Cancer Institute of Canada, is about to open, I believe, a study of lenalidomide and rituximab compared to rituximab plus chemotherapy in patients who need treatment, so symptomatic patients with follicular lymphoma. So something out to look out for coming up very soon. So I'm just going to touch on the last few slides, again, finishing with Mrs. Y. So she recently, unfortunately, after about 5 years or so of follow-up, did note some increasing lymph nodes and fatigue. We did repeat a biopsy just to confirm we were still dealing with follicular lymphoma and not, again, that transformation to a more aggressive behaving lymphoma. Ultimately, because of her symptoms, Mrs. Y and her family decided it was time to start her treatment. And in the absence of clinical trials, we discussed using CVP and rituximab followed by maintenance rituximab. She just had a few questions about what else can I do during my treatment. Mike has already talked about this study in Edmonton. It was a randomized trial looking at whether patients can exercise or should exercise during their lymphoma treatment. So they took 120 patients and randomly assigned them to either whatever they normally did, so if you exercise, that's great, and if you didn't, that's okay, or to a pretty vigorous exercise program. So it was about 3 times per week, starting off at about 20 minutes and then up to about 45 minutes over a period of 3 months. And they looked at whether or not their self-rated physical function improved over that time frame. So in terms of the results, they found that about 1 in 5 people who were in the usual care arm would exercise. But they found that people who were assigned to the aerobic exercise, there was about a 92% compliance. So 92% of people who were assigned to that arm actually stuck to the exercise for the full 3 months. I would never do that. That's impressive. And ultimately, they found really everything was better in the aerobic exercise group. So self-rated physical function, there was a scale that measured happiness, and overall quality of life was better in the aerobic exercisers, and then lean body mass improved. There was actually no difference, though, in terms of lymphoma recurrence, although this wasn't the primary design of the study to look at that. If you just break it down a little bit more, I know this is hard to see, but the blue bars are people who were getting the usual care. The yellow bars are the people who did the aerobic exercise. And this is a scale looking, again, at physical function, so the higher, the better. You can see that regardless of whether people had aggressive histology lymphomas or indolent histology lymphomas, so across the board, the people who were exercising actually had higher physical function scores. And again, even during chemotherapy, higher scores, and off of treatment. So it seems across the board, whatever your type of lymphoma, whether you're on treatment or not, exercise we would consider very important. What about diet? We're very often asked what we should eat in the middle of treatment. Well, generally, I would say that as long as you're following a fairly healthy routine diet, I think you can continue on with your routine. I often recommend looking up on Google things like the Harvard Healthy Eating Plate or Harvard Health Pyramid in terms of just what balance of vegetables, healthy proteins, and fruits we should be including in our diet. There are actually no approved appetite stimulants currently available. People often ask us about Megase, but that was actually a drug studied more in HIV settings and not as much in cancer. There are some upcoming very early studies of drugs like beta-hydroxy, beta-methylbutyrate, and fish oil, but again, very early studies. So again, no currently approved drugs for appetite stimulation. There can be some diet modifications that can be helpful for nausea. A lot of our patients tell us about that it's very helpful to stay hydrated. Splitting up your meals into very, very small meals and snacks over the course of the day instead of three large meals. avoiding oily foods that tend to stay in your stomach for a long period of time. A lot of nausea is related to smells from food, so we tend to suggest, and that seems to be a lot more in hot foods, so considering more room temperature or cool foods. Again, the smell issue, trying maybe to drink fluids with straws and out of a sippy cup, so covered lids. There's some studies of ginger in the post-surgery or pregnancy setting, but not as much in cancer at this point in time. Some people try it, and I think it's a safe option, but not a lot of evidence. And just finally, complementary alternative medicines. Is it done in lymphoma patients? So certainly there was a recent study in the U.S. that found close to 70% of lymphoma patients use some form of complementary alternative medicine. Most of this is would be in the form of practices like chiropractic manipulation, massage. But some would be in the form of, and probably more clinically relevant for us, some products like herbal remedies, green teas, garlic, St. John's wort, etc. And unfortunately, 70-90% of the people who do use CAMs actually don't tell their physicians that they're using CAM. So a couple of issues. I mean, one is that at this point, again, there are no alternative therapies that have firm scientific evidence that show that it actually improves or affects lymphoma outcomes. I think the choice of whether you choose to use CAMs probably comes down to, again, this partnership between the physician and patient and adequate communication. On our end, I think doctors need to understand that patients certainly have the right to choose CAMs. I think doctors should try and make an effort to understand why patients are seeking them. In some circumstances, individuals might seek these complementary medications when conventional therapies have been exhausted. What we hear a lot is that the conventional therapies as well are somewhat spiritually or emotionally empty, and a lot of individuals will go to the complementary medications when which they feel are a lot more comforting. I think from our perspective, we kind of hope that patients would at least understand our reservations or perspective. So I often talk to our patients about the fact that a lot of these compounds are actually not regulated, so we don't even have a very general sense of what components are in them and whether they're safe or not. Some practitioners as well are actually not regulated, and we've had some circumstances where, you know, our patients have been promised really extreme outcomes and have been asked to pay extreme amounts as well. And probably one of our biggest concerns is that some of these compounds can actually interact with our conventional therapies that actually do have proven benefit. So, you know, ultimately I do say that we certainly support if you do want to use complementary medications, I would support it. It's your choice. We often tell people just to be honest with us, tell us. And if there is that opportunity, we would ask that patients consider at least holding off until the end of their treatment, their conventional treatments, so that we can be at least sure of it being safe and not interacting with those drugs. And this is the final slide. It's just to mention that after treatment is completed, there is still ongoing care, especially in the indolent lymphomas. So certainly we would at once repeat the staging test to see if the lymphoma is at that point in remission. There still is going to be that ongoing period of maintenance rituximab. And the goal, again, for the treatment in indolent lymphomas is often a hope that we've attained a long period of disease control or remission before at some point we have to retreat the lymphoma. We would still recommend follow-up with your family physician, and John this afternoon is going to talk a little bit more about some of these issues. And then, again, with us, it's at first every 3 months. So I'll leave it at that, and hopefully there's still a bit of time for discussion. Thanks.